A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So this is probably one of the weirder questions I'll ask you. And sometimes I have to say, I do think to myself, maybe I don't want to put this on the internet. But you know what? After getting on 3,000 episodes, it's kind of everything. All my internal ruminations for the past few months have been talked about in the My Word Prompts podcast. So if anyone actually is listening out there, and we do have more than 150,000 plays, so somebody probably is. You've heard about my bloating issues after gallbladder surgery, and yes, I am working towards getting to the bottom of it. I had some a luncheon about an hour ago, and you might be able to hear that I'm really bloated currently. I mean, you can't see me, but those little short gasps is because my stomach is all like, ugh, it's like out there. And yeah, I'm bloated basically. And this is the post-eating and often post-drinking bloat that has been driving me absolutely up the walls for the past 7 years. And to date, haven't really found much success through traditional medical channels. The closest I've come, as mentioned, was getting a diagnosis of abdominophrenic dysinertia, which sounds so much cooler than it, just being insanely bloated. And no one really knows why. I don't think it's actually quite that unspecific. In fact, I take that back, because I think it describes a problematic coordination of the abdominal muscles and the diaphragm. And the only issue is that there is no real obvious treatment yet, but some guy in Barcelona, who Herman Poppleberry will probably dredge up his name, has been doing some work in this regard. Now, here is my question for today. If you go to your average family doctor and you say, hey, I've been, you know, I had gallbladder surgery, and every time I eat or drink, I'm super, super bloated. The first question they will want to ask is, do you feel bloated or are you bloated? And in my case, I'm really actually bloated. Like, I'm physically distended. I measured it with a measuring tape once, but, and I took some really, you know, some photos that I really hope if my Google account is ever hacked or whatever, that those are not the photos people would be looking at. But they're there, and they do show that I go from looking like a fairly healthy man of 37 through to looking like a medical miracle of a man about to give birth to a child. I look kind of pregnant, basically. Now, here's my thought, the slightly crazy idea maybe, but I want to put it out there. Telemedicine is, of course, a really big thing. And I'm into the idea that, I guess, you know, I would probably at this point travel the world to see a specialist who might be able to offer any kind of answer or relief. And what I was thinking was this. I know that the pattern of bloating is kind of important. It kind of, you know, you can literally see from the way your distension occurs what muscles are sort of what's going on. And I had the crazy idea that if I took my phone and put it on a tripod at some point in time that I wasn't bloated and recorded, you know, edit something that I know is going to provoke bloating, like a big, like a meal, or even drunk some water, or tried it on different things and recorded my stomach in such a way that either looking at it like sped up might actually be able to show some potentially useful diagnostic information about what's actually going on or what specific muscles might be involved. Now, my question is for Herman Poppleberry, especially, given, you know, what he knows about bloating and whatever, how would you actually set this up? Because I was thinking to myself that if I just used a kind of head-on view, like a straight angle, 0 degrees offset, that it might miss, like, I was thinking 45 degrees might be the best, or maybe even set up a couple of cameras. I'm wondering if anyone's actually done or tried something like this, or even if they haven't, if you've any ideas as to what might be the best way to actually do this. It wouldn't be, you know, torturous to just kind of listen to you guys, the My Word Prompts podcast, while I record this experiment a few times. And maybe, I don't know, do you think there's any way that either with a doctor, or this could be useful even with AI, that I could even maybe say, these are the muscles that seem involved, but probably this would be something for a very open-minded doctor to look at. But I'm thinking about doing it. How would I do it? Over to you.
Daniel sent us this one, and I have to say, it's the kind of question that could only come from someone who's been living with something for 7 years and has gotten creative about it. He's been dealing with post-gallbladder surgery bloating, real, measurable physical distension after eating or drinking. He got a diagnosis of abdominophrenic dyssynergia, which he describes as a coordination problem between the abdominal muscles and the diaphragm. No obvious treatment yet, though there's a researcher in Barcelona working on it. Here's the actual question. He wants to set up a camera, or cameras, to record his stomach before and after a provocative meal, speed up the footage, and see if the visual pattern of distension reveals anything diagnostically useful about which muscles are involved. He's asking how to set this up, what angles to use, and whether this could actually be useful with a doctor or AI. Herman, you're the one who's been down every rabbit hole on this topic. What do we make of this?
I love this question. It's the kind of thing someone does when they've exhausted the standard pathways and they're still curious enough to experiment, and the premise isn't crazy at all. Let me start with the diagnosis itself. Abdominophrenic dyssynergia describes a real physiological phenomenon. The diaphragm and the abdominal wall are supposed to coordinate. When you inhale, the diaphragm descends and the abdominal wall relaxes and expands slightly. When you exhale, the diaphragm rises and the abdominal wall contracts. In abdominophrenic dyssynergia, that coordination breaks down. Instead of the diaphragm descending and the belly relaxing, the diaphragm descends and the abdominal muscles contract at the same time. The result is that the contents of the abdomen get pushed forward and you get visible, often dramatic distension.
It's not a gas problem. It's a choreography problem.
And that's why so many treatments fail. If you treat it as excess gas, you're treating a symptom of a symptom. The root issue is neuromuscular coordination. The researcher Daniel mentioned, I'm fairly certain he's thinking of Dr. Fernando Espiroz at the University Hospital Vall de Hebron in Barcelona. Espiroz has been publishing on this for decades. He's one of the few people in the world who has systematically studied visible abdominal distension as a distinct phenomenon from the sensation of bloating. And that distinction, do you feel bloated or are you bloated? That's the critical clinical question most doctors don't ask well.
Which is wild, because the prompt mentions family doctors ask it, but they apparently don't know what to do with the answer.
Asparaz's group published a paper in the American Journal of Gastroenterology where they used abdominal inductance plethysmography to measure girth changes in real time. They found that patients with functional bloating showed actual increases in abdominal girth 3 to 5 centimeters over a few hours that correlated with meals, and the distension wasn't caused by increased intestinal gas volume alone. It was caused by a redistribution of abdominal contents driven by this dyssynergic muscle pattern.
3 to 5 centimeters. That's measurable with a tape measure at home, which the prompt mentions having done.
That's the thing. Daniel's already doing what Espiroz's lab did, just with consumer tools. The tape measure, the photos, the systematic provocation. He's essentially running an N-of-1 clinical trial. The question is whether adding video analysis moves the needle.
Let's get into the setup. He's asking about angles. Head-on versus 45 degrees. What actually captures the relevant information?
The key diagnostic feature in abdominophrenic dyssynergia is the paradoxical movement pattern. Normally, when you breathe in deeply, your belly should expand. In the dyssynergic pattern, you often see the lower abdomen protrude while the upper abdomen remains flat or even contracts, or the entire abdominal wall tightens and pushes outward in a way that looks different from normal post-meal fullness.
You're looking for asymmetry and paradoxical motion.
And that dictates the camera setup. A single head-on view is useful, but only if you have reference points. You'll see the silhouette change, but you won't capture the anterior-posterior dimension, how far forward the abdomen is projecting. That's where the 45-degree angle becomes valuable. It gives you depth information that a straight-on shot misses. You can see the profile of the abdominal contour changing in three dimensions.
The silhouette from the side tells a different story than the silhouette from the front.
Ideally, you'd want at least two angles. I'd recommend one camera at 0 degrees, straight on, aligned with the navel, at navel height, and a second camera at 90 degrees, directly from the side. The side view captures the anterior projection, which is often the most dramatic change. If you can only do one camera, I'd argue for the side view over the front view, because the anterior-posterior change is more diagnostically informative for this specific condition.
The prompt suggested 45 degrees as a compromise. You're saying go full profile.
If you have to pick one, make it 90 degrees. 45 degrees gives you a bit of both dimensions, but masters neither. If you can do two cameras, do 0 and 90. If you can do three, add a 45 degree oblique. But the diminishing returns kick in fast after two.
What about lighting and markers?
If you're going to show this footage to a clinician or run it through any kind of automated analysis, you need consistent reference points. I'd suggest placing small adhesive markers at specific anatomical landmarks. The xiphoid process, the bottom tip of the sternum, the anterior superior iliac spines on both sides, the bony prominences at the front of your hip bones, and maybe one at the pubic symphysis. These give you a fixed coordinate system so that when the abdomen distends, you can see exactly where the expansion is happening relative to the skeleton.
Like motion capture dots, but for a very unglamorous purpose.
The least glamorous motion capture in history, but it works. I'd also add a fixed reference object in frame, something of known size that doesn't move. A ruler taped to the wall behind you or a marked pole. This lets you calibrate measurements if you're doing quantitative analysis later.
The setup is consistent lighting, fixed camera positions, anatomical markers, a reference object, and ideally two cameras. What about the actual protocol? He mentioned recording before and after a provocative meal.
The protocol matters enormously. You want a baseline period, at least 10 to 15 minutes of recording before any food or drink in a fasted state. The prompt mentions that even drinking water can provoke this, which is clinically interesting. That suggests the trigger is gastric filling of any kind, not just specific foods. So you could design a graded provocation. Start with water. A measured volume, say 500 milliliters, consumed over 5 minutes. Record for 30 minutes. Then, if no significant distension occurs, add a standardized meal. The key word is standardized. Same food, same quantity, same consumption rate across every session.
Because if you vary the input, you can't compare the outputs.
And this is where most self-experimentation falls apart. People change too many variables at once. Pick one meal that reliably provokes symptoms and use it every time. Document exactly what it is, how much, and how fast you eat it.
The prompt mentions possibly doing this multiple times. I think that's actually the most important part. A single recording is a data point. Multiple recordings are a data set.
With a data set, you can start to see patterns that aren't visible in a single session. Does the distension always follow the same trajectory? Does it start in the lower abdomen and move upward, or does it happen all at once? Is there a particular breathing pattern that precedes it? These become apparent when you can compare multiple time-lapse sequences side by side.
Let's talk about the time-lapse aspect. The prompt suggests speeding up the footage. How fast are we talking?
If you're recording for, say, 2 hours, 30 minutes baseline, then 90 minutes post-meal. At 30 frames per second, that's 216,000 frames. You don't want to watch that in real time. But the speed matters. If you compress 2 hours into 2 minutes, that's a 60-to-1 compression. You'll see gross changes in contour, but you might miss subtle paradoxical movements that happen on the time scale of individual breaths. I'd suggest doing multiple playback speeds. A fast version, maybe 120 times speed, to see the overall trajectory. Then a slower version, maybe 10 to 20 times speed, where you can still see individual respiratory cycles and how the abdominal wall moves with each breath.
You're not just looking at the meal response. You're looking at breathing mechanics superimposed on the meal response.
And that's the diagnostic gold hidden in this experiment. In abdominophrenic dyssynergia, the paradoxical movement is often most visible during deep inspiration. If you watch a time-lapse at the right speed, you might see that with each breath, the abdomen contracts when it should expand, or it bulges asymmetrically. That's the kind of thing a trained eye can spot, and it's hard to describe in a clinical visit, but immediately visible on video.
You keep saying trained eye. The prompt asks whether AI could help here. What's your take?
I think we're closer to that being practical than most people realize. Computer vision has gotten remarkably good at pose estimation and movement analysis. There are open source libraries, MediaPipe, OpenPose, that can track body landmarks from video. If you place those adhesive markers I mentioned, you're giving the computer vision system an easy job. It can track the positions of those markers frame by frame, calculate distances between them, and plot how those distances change over time.
You could literally generate a graph of navel to exavoid distance over the 2-hour recording period.
And you could do it for multiple marker pairs, navel to left hip, navel to right hip, xiphoid to pubic symphysis. You'd end up with a multidimensional dataset showing exactly how the abdominal wall deforms over time. That's the kind of thing you could hand to a gastroenterologist and say, here's what's happening. These are the muscles involved. This is the pattern.
The prompt asks whether any doctor would actually look at this. I think that's the real question. You can generate beautiful data, but if no clinician will engage with it, you build a very elaborate art project.
This is the cultural problem in medicine. Most gastroenterologists are trained to think in terms of endoscopy findings, imaging reports, lab values. A patient-generated video analysis doesn't fit into the standard diagnostic workflow, but there are clinicians who would engage with this. The motility specialists, the functional GI people, the ones who already think in terms of neuromuscular coordination rather than structural abnormalities. Esperaz's group in Barcelona is the obvious example. There are others. The motility clinic at Mayo, some of the neurogastroenterology groups at academic centers. These are people who already use techniques like abdominal plethysmography and dynamic M, our eye to study this exact phenomenon.
The experiment isn't crazy. The challenge is finding the right audience for the results.
That's true of a lot of patient-generated data. The technology now exists to collect incredibly rich physiological data at home. Continuous glucose monitors, sleep trackers, heart rate variability, and now video-based motion analysis. The bottleneck isn't the data collection, it's the clinical interpretation infrastructure. Most doctors don't have the time, the training, or the reimbursement model to engage with patient-generated data at this level of detail.
Which is where AI potentially fills a gap, not replacing the clinician, but pre-processing the data into a form that's clinically digestible.
If you can hand a doctor a one-page summary that says, over a 2-hour postprandial period, abdominal girth increased by 4.2 centimeters, with the expansion concentrated in the lower abdominal quadrant. Paradoxical inward motion of the upper abdominal wall was observed during deep inspiration, consistent with abdominophrenic dyssynergia. That's a very different conversation than, hey doc, I filmed my stomach, want to watch a 2-hour time lapse?
The prompt mentions possibly doing this while listening to our podcast. I appreciate the multitasking, but if you're trying to control for variables, shouldn't you be in a consistent psychological state?
If the podcast episode is different every time and your emotional response varies, that could affect breathing patterns and muscle tension. Better to listen to the same thing every time, or nothing. White noise or silence. You want the only variable to be the food or drink.
Control the controllables. So let's say someone actually does this experiment. They set up 2 cameras, place markers, record baseline and post-meal, generate time lapses. What should they actually look for? What are the specific visual signatures that would suggest abdominophrenic dyssynergia versus just normal post-meal fullness?
Normal post-meal distension is usually symmetrical and gradual. The entire abdomen expands slightly and evenly as the stomach fills. There's no visible paradox with breathing. The belly still expands on inspiration and contracts on expiration, just from a slightly larger baseline. In abdominophrenic dyssynergia, you'd look for several specific things. Does one side protrude more than the other? Second, segmental expansion. Does the lower abdomen balloon out while the upper abdomen stays flat or even retracts? Third, and most diagnostically telling, paradoxical breathing motion. On the time lapse at respiratory speed, watch what happens during a deep breath. If the upper abdomen pulls inward while the lower abdomen pushes outward, that's the classic dyssynergic pattern.
What about timing? Is there a characteristic time course?
Aspirasa's work suggests the distension often begins within 15 to 30 minutes of meal ingestion and can continue to increase for 2 to 3 hours. But the key feature is that it's progressive and meal-dependent. If someone has constant distension that doesn't vary with meals, that suggests a different mechanism, possibly visceral fat, ascites, or something structural. The meal dependence is diagnostically important.
The prompt mentions this has been going on for 7 years. That's a long time to be running a self-experiment without answers.
And it speaks to how poorly the medical system handles functional disorders. If you have a clear structural problem, a blocked bile duct, a tumor, an ulcer, the diagnostic pathway is well-defined and treatments are established. But when the problem is coordination, when it's a software bug rather than a hardware failure, the system struggles. Patients get bounced between specialists, told it's in their head, offered treatments that don't address the mechanism. 7 years is not unusual for a functional GI disorder to go undiagnosed or inadequately treated.
There's something darkly funny about the phrase software bug applied to the human body.
It's not a perfect analogy, but it captures something real. The gut has its own nervous system, the enteric nervous system, sometimes called the second brain. It has complex reflex arcs that coordinate motility, secretion, blood flow. When those reflexes get disrupted, by surgery, by inflammation, the result can be a functional disorder that looks normal on every standard test but produces dramatic symptoms.
Gallbladder surgery is a known trigger for this.
Post-cholecystectomy syndrome is a recognized entity. Though it's a garbage bin diagnosis covering everything from retained stones to sphincter of Oddi dysfunction to functional dyspepsia. The connection to abdominophrenic dyssynergia specifically isn't as well established in the literature, but there's a plausible mechanism. The gallbladder sits under the liver, tucked up against the diaphragm. Any abdominal surgery can disrupt the normal proprioceptive feedback loops between the abdominal wall, the diaphragm, and the visceral organs. The body learns a new pattern of muscle activation to protect the surgical site, and that pattern can persist long after the tissue has healed.
The surgery creates a maladaptive motor pattern, and the pattern becomes entrenched.
That's the theory. And if that's what's happening, the treatment isn't pharmacological, it's neuromuscular retraining. Teaching the diaphragm and the abdominal wall to coordinate again. Aspirasa's group has published on this too. They've used electromyography, guided biofeedback, to treat abdominophrenic dyssynergia, with some success.
Which brings us back to the video experiment. If you can visualize the dyssynergic pattern, you've not only got a diagnostic tool, you've potentially got a biofeedback tool. Record yourself, watch the recording, learn to recognize the pattern, and consciously correct it.
This is the same principle used in other forms of biofeedback. You externalize a physiological signal that's normally unconscious, and by observing it, you gain the ability to modulate it. If Daniel can see on video that his upper abdomen contracts paradoxically during inspiration, he can practice, literally practice, in front of a mirror or a camera, breathing in a way that keeps the abdominal wall relaxed and allows the diaphragm to descend properly.
It's physical therapy for breathing. Which sounds absurdly simple, but if the problem is a learned motor pattern, the solution is learning a different motor pattern.
This is where the video experiment has value beyond diagnosis. Even if no doctor ever looks at the footage, the act of recording and reviewing it might be therapeutic. You develop interoceptive awareness, the ability to sense what's happening inside your body. Most of us are terrible at this. We know we feel bad, but we can't describe the specific sensations or connect them to specific physiological events. Video externalizes it. You can see, frame by frame, what your body is doing.
The prompt mentions that the closest thing to a useful diagnosis so far has been abdominophrenic dyssynergia, and that there's no obvious treatment. But you're describing a treatment pathway that doesn't require a drug or a procedure. Just awareness and retraining.
I want to be careful not to overpromise. Biofeedback for functional abdominal distension is not a well-validated treatment with large randomized trials behind it. The evidence base is small. Aspirasa's group has published case series, not multi-center randomized controlled trials. But the mechanism makes sense. The risks are essentially zero, and the alternative is 7 more years of distension without answers. In that context, an N-of-1 self-experiment with video biofeedback seems entirely reasonable.
Let's talk about practical details. The prompt asks specifically about camera setup, phone on a tripod. Does it matter?
Most modern smartphones shoot video that's more than adequate. You want at least 1080p resolution, and you want to lock the exposure and white balance so they don't shift during the recording. On an iPhone, you long press to lock AEAF. You also want to make sure the phone isn't going to run out of storage or battery during a 2-hour recording. 2 hours of 1080p video at 30 frames per second is roughly 20 to 30 gigabytes, depending on compression. Make sure you've got the space.
The tripod needs to be stable. A flimsy tripod that drifts over 2 hours ruins the measurement.
You want a solid tripod on a hard floor, not carpet, and you want to mark the position with tape so you can replicate the exact setup across sessions. Consistency is everything. If the camera moves even slightly between sessions, you can't directly compare the footage.
What about clothing? The prompt mentions visible distension, but presumably you need to actually see the abdomen.
The abdominal wall needs to be visible. Tight-fitting clothing that can be pulled up or just recording without a shirt. The markers need to be placed directly on the skin. This is not a glamorous experiment.
The prompt acknowledges this with some self-deprecating humor about the photos on Google. I appreciate the willingness to be candid about how absurd this all is, while still taking it seriously.
That's the right attitude. You have to be able to laugh at the situation while still pursuing answers. The alternative is either giving up or becoming consumed by it.
To summarize the setup, 2 cameras if possible. 0 degrees front, 90 degrees side. If only one, go with the side view. Adhesive markers at xiphoid, navel, both hip bones, pubic symphysis. Fixed reference object in frame. Locked exposure and white balance. Solid tripod on a marked position. Standardized provocative meal. Same food, same quantity, same timing every session. Record 15 to 30 minutes baseline fasted, then consume the meal, then record for 90 minutes to 2 hours.
If water alone provokes symptoms, start with water. It's a cleaner provocation. No confounding from food composition. 500 milliliters, consume steadily over 5 minutes, record for an hour. If that reliably produces distension, you've got a beautifully simple experimental protocol.
Then the analysis. Generate time lapses at multiple speeds. Look for asymmetry, segmental expansion, paradoxical breathing motion. Optionally, use computer vision tools to track marker positions and quantify the changes.
If you do all of that, you've got something genuinely useful. Not just for your own understanding, but potentially for a clinician who's willing to engage with patient-generated data. The key is to present it concisely. Don't walk into a doctor's office with a 2-hour video and expect them to watch it. Walk in with a 1-page summary, a few key still frames showing the before and after, and maybe a 30-second time lapse that captures the most dramatic changes. Make it easy for them to see what you're seeing.
There's a broader point here about the future of diagnosis. We're moving into an era where patients can generate clinical quality physiological data at home. The bottleneck is interpretation. AI will help with that. We're already seeing computer vision models that can detect gait abnormalities, facial palsy, skin lesions with accuracy comparable to specialists. Abdominal wall motion analysis is a niche application, but the underlying technology is the same.
The nice thing about this particular application is that the movements are relatively large and slow. You're not trying to track micro-expressions or subtle tremors. You're tracking centimeter-scale changes in abdominal contour over minutes to hours. That's an easy problem for computer vision. The hard part is the clinical validation. Connecting specific movement patterns to specific diagnoses with known treatment implications. That takes clinical trials, not just engineering.
Which is why the Barcelona group is interesting. They've been doing the clinical validation work for years. If someone were to replicate their plethysmography findings using nothing but a smartphone and some adhesive dots, that's a paper. That's actually publishable.
A case report of patient-led video analysis correlating with clinical plethysmography findings would be a nice contribution to the literature. It wouldn't change practice overnight, but it would add to the evidence base that says, this is real, this is measurable, and patients can do this at home.
The prompt asks whether anyone has actually tried this. I did some looking, and I couldn't find published examples of exactly this patient-recorded time-lapse video for abdominal distension analysis. There's plenty of research using motion capture and plethysmography in lab settings, but the self-experiment with a phone on a tripod seems to be novel, which doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It means it's an idea whose time has come, and the tools have only recently become good enough and cheap enough to make it practical.
The democratization of diagnostic tools is a theme we keep coming back to. 20 years ago, if you wanted to do abdominal plethysmography, you needed a research lab with specialized equipment. Today, you need a phone, a tripod, and some patients. The barrier isn't technology anymore, it's the clinical culture that hasn't caught up.
If someone listening is in a similar situation, post-surgical bloating, no clear answers, frustrated with the standard pathways, what would you tell them?
I'd say the experiment is worth doing, with realistic expectations. It might not lead to a diagnosis or a treatment, but it will almost certainly give you a better understanding of what's happening in your body, and that understanding has value in itself. At minimum, you'll have a clear record to show clinicians. At best, you might identify a pattern that points toward a specific intervention, biofeedback, physical therapy, breathing retraining. And the cost, in terms of money and risk, is essentially zero.
The only cost is the existential discomfort of watching your own abdomen in time-lapse, which, I grant, is not nothing.
It's a peculiar form of self-confrontation, but people do stranger things in the pursuit of health answers. At least this one doesn't involve restrictive diets or unproven supplements.
Or leaf medicine.
I was not going to say it.
You didn't have to.
I will note, since we're on the topic of muscle coordination, that there's an interesting parallel with something I've seen in archery. When you're learning to shoot, you develop all kinds of subtle tension patterns you're not aware of. You grip the bow too hard, you hunch your shoulder, you hold your breath. The only way to fix it is to externalize the feedback. Video yourself, have a coach watch you, use a pressure sensor. You can't fix what you can't perceive.
The bloating is the archery of the abdomen.
I'm not sure that phrase has ever been uttered before, but yes, essentially. It's a motor skill that's been learned incorrectly, and unlearning it requires awareness.
The prompt also raises an interesting secondary question about whether AI could identify specific muscles from the video. I think that's a harder problem than it sounds. The abdominal wall is composed of four main muscle groups: rectus abdominis, external obliques, internal obliques, transversus abdominis, and they're layered. From surface video alone, you can't easily distinguish which layer is activating. You'd need electromyography for that.
Surface video can tell you about the overall pattern of deformation, but it can't tell you which specific muscle is contracting. That said, the pattern of deformation does give clues. If the upper abdomen is pulling inward while the lower abdomen bulges, that suggests the upper rectus is contracting while the lower abdominal wall is relaxed or passively stretched. A clinician familiar with abdominal wall mechanics can make reasonable inferences.
AI could potentially classify patterns. This looks like upper abdominal contraction with lower abdominal protrusion, without necessarily identifying individual muscles. That's still useful.
And there are research groups working on exactly this, using computer vision to analyze abdominal wall motion for respiratory monitoring, post-surgical recovery assessment, physical therapy. The application to functional bloating is niche, but the technical approach is transferable.
Let's talk about the Barcelona connection a bit more. If someone actually generates compelling video evidence of abdominophrenic dyssynergia, is it realistic to think they could get a consultation with Asparoz's group?
Academic medical centers do accept international referrals, though wait times can be long. Asparoz's group has a specific research interest in this condition, which makes them more likely to engage with a well-documented case. The practical approach would be to write a concise email with a summary of the history, the diagnosis to date, and a link to the video analysis. Don't send the video as an attachment. Upload it somewhere and include a link. Keep the email brief. Academic physicians are drowning in email, and a long emotional appeal will get skimmed or ignored. A tight factual summary with clear visual evidence is more likely to get a response.
This is the grant proposal approach to medical self-advocacy.
It shouldn't have to be, but it is. The patients who get answers in complex functional disorders are often the ones who become amateur experts in their own condition and advocate for themselves with organized, evidence-based arguments. It's not fair, but it's the reality of a medical system optimized for acute care that struggles with chronic, complex conditions.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the distinction between feeling bloated and being bloated. The prompt mentions that family doctors ask this question, but don't seem to know what to do with the answer. Why is that distinction so important? And why is it so often a dead end?
The distinction matters because it points to different mechanisms. The sensation of bloating without visible distension is often a visceral hypersensitivity issue. The nerves in the gut are overreacting to normal amounts of gas or stretch. Visible distension with measurable girth increase is about volume redistribution, muscle coordination, or actual increases in intraluminal content. But here's the problem. In a 10-minute primary care visit, the doctor asks the question, establishes that the distension is real, and then has nowhere to go. There's no standard blood test for abdominophrenic dyssynergia. There's no imaging protocol. There's no guideline that says, if patient has visible postprandial distension, refer to motility specialist for plethysmography. So the conversation stalls and the patient leaves with a diagnosis of exclusion, functional bloating, and no treatment plan.
Which is how you end up, 7 years later, designing a multi-camera time-lapse experiment in your own home.
The experiment exists because the standard pathway failed. And that's not a criticism of individual doctors. It's a criticism of a system that doesn't have good pathways for functional disorders.
One last practical question, and then we should wrap up. The prompt mentions doing this while listening to our podcast. Setting aside the confounding variable issue we already discussed, is there any reason to think that being relaxed and distracted would actually help the experiment? If the dyssynergic pattern is partly driven by conscious or unconscious guarding, maybe being distracted lets the natural pathological pattern emerge more clearly.
That's an interesting point. If there's a component of voluntary or anxiety-driven muscle tension, distraction might reveal the underlying physiological pattern more clearly than focused self-observation would. This is a known phenomenon in movement disorders, the tremor that disappears when the patient is distracted, the dystonia that worsens with attention. If abdominal distension has a similar attentional component, then listening to a podcast might be a better experimental condition than sitting in silence thinking about your stomach.
Our podcast is a diagnostic tool. That's a new one.
We've been called many things. Diagnostic aid is a first.
I'll take it. All right, let's land this. The experiment is worth doing. Two cameras, side and front. Markers and reference objects. Time lapses at multiple speeds. Look for asymmetry and paradoxical breathing. AI can help quantify, but the human eye is still the best pattern recognizer. And if the results are compelling, there are clinicians who will look at them. You just have to find the right ones and present the data concisely.
Don't underestimate the biofeedback potential. Even without a doctor, watching your own movement patterns can be therapeutic. Awareness is the first step to change.
The prompt ends with, over to you. I think we've taken it as far as two non-gastroenterologists can. The rest is up to the experimenter.
I'd love to hear how it goes. Not on the air necessarily, but somewhere. This is the kind of patient-led investigation that pushes medicine forward, one in of one at a time. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, astronomers observing the moon from Mauritius noted that lunar libration, the apparent wobble of the moon's face, produces a subtle acoustic shadow effect on Earth's atmosphere. The shifting gravitational pull during maximum libration in latitude creates an infrasonic standing wave at approximately 0.003 Hz, which, when transduced through the Indian Ocean's surface, generates a faint hum detectable by submerged hydrophones. Mauritian harbor masters of the 1880s referred to this as the moon's bass note, though they had no instruments capable of recording it directly.
The moon's bass note. Of course there is.
That's not how any of this works, but thank you.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running, and to everyone who sends in questions that make us think about things we never expected to think about. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
The thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.